Welcome to the Talk Floor Podcast, where we talk all things flooring. And now, your host, Dave Foster.
Okay, we are back. John Roberts is with us. He's been with us any number of times. He's a retailer. He is the CEO of Central Alabama Flooring. He has five stores, a Wheat Carpet One. He has two Don Carpet Ones, a Big Bob's, and a Pro Source, and maybe more added to that, I guess. We'll ask him that as we go forward here. Don, how you doing?
Doing great, David. My life is good. Can't complain. A little scary out there, though, sometimes, but I hear things are good.
And one thing I also wanted to mention is you are executive director of the FCEF, the Floor Covering Educational Foundation.
Which I want to actually, talk. I'm their chairman, chairman on the board. And Jim Aaron is our executive director.
Well, I knew that. When I wrote down executive director, whatever I write down, I say, I guess.
You know? Hey, it doesn't matter what you call me. People call me a heck of a lot worse. So it happens.
What I wanted to start off with was, you know, these are some unusual times. Nobody knows what's going to happen with the economy. If you ask them, they're probably not going to say something very positive. We're dealing with price increases, fuel surcharges, supply chain problems, and so on. Talk about being a floor covering retailer among all these situations.
Well, you know, I think everybody's dealing with these things in their own level, depending on the structure of their businesses and stuff like that. You know, one of the things that I've always tried to do is advocate for the independent dealer. And, you know, I've got five stores, so I've got the ability to put costs across, you know, multiple locations to get things done that I need done. But a lot of these independent dealers that are, you know, they're one store operation, they still got to do all the same things that I've got to do, you know, with the financials that they have in their business. And keeping up with these price increases is bad enough, but when you've got manufacturers out there that, and again, I understand they need to raise prices, and I don't think any of the dealers out there worry about them raising prices as long as it goes across the board and it's fair to everybody. But it's when they raise it in a way that is hard to keep up with. For example, you know, you've got your typical invoice, which would be the materials and the freight to go with those materials. But now, you know, and because some manufacturers have got long-term contracts with people and they can't break those things, the only thing they can go after is things like, you know, freight or fuel or whatever. And you start seeing all different extra charges put on there, you know, handling fees, you know, fuel surcharges. I even had a vendor put on an excess wrapping cost because they had to wrap, I guess, the product with a lot more plastic than they normally would have. I just thought, I'm thinking, well, there's a creative one, but how do you keep up with that stuff in your pricing? You know, I use, everybody knows, I use RFMS, and I think RFMS does a great job of keeping up with, you know, these type of things. But, you know, we've been reaching out to the FCB2B people lately to get their help with some of these things and get it so that if there is going to be a fuel surcharge or if there's going to be a handling fee, that it'll be able to come to us in the pricing file so that we can margin all of these things and pass that cost on to the consumer. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the consumer that pays for all of this stuff. You know, we shouldn't be absorbing fuel surcharges. We shouldn't be absorbing handling fees. But we do have to have a better way for dealers to be able to handle it and be able to not lose margin. I'll give you a great example. I've got a vendor that I just found out because I'm doing my own payables now because my bookkeeper stealing, which is a whole other fun thing that you got to deal with. But I find out that this vendor is billing me my freight like 2 to 3 weeks after I get my invoice, and I've already posted and costed my invoice to my ticket. You know, so instead of getting the freight with the invoice, I'm getting it 3 weeks later and having to jump through hoops labor-wise to, you know, open orders, you know, repost and do all those type of things. When frankly, why didn't they just send me all my invoices with the freight bill so we could have taken care of it at the same time? So I think we're staying ahead of the margin increases and stuff like that with the pricing, but it's just taking so much more time of management for these dealers. And again, if you're a one-store operation, you know, you may only have a couple salespeople on the floor, and you may be doing everything else in the background, and you're just working your fanny to death. I mean, you're working 7 days a week now to keep up with this stuff.
Do you know all the add-ons at the front end?
Oh, no, heck no. I mean, you have a good idea with, you know, when you deal with certain vendors time and time again, but no, not to mention they change. I got one distributor that thinks he's a trader on the stock market. He posts his freight costs every Monday for the freight that's going to be delivered that week. And it's probably on an order that I ordered 6 weeks ago because I've been waiting for the product. So how do I tie that back to my customer and say, oh, by the way, Ms. Jones, you ordered your product 6 weeks ago because we told you to order it up because you're ordering it in a hurry because we needed to get it ordered for you. But then the freight comes in 2 months later or whatever. Oh, by the way, you're going to have to pay more for it. You know, so we end up eating these things. And that's not a good thing, you know.
How frequent have the price increases been on product itself?
It depends. It depends on the vendor. You know, the cabinet companies seem to be doing it differently. They give us bigger increases, but they do it, you know, on a maybe a quarterly basis, maybe bi-monthly basis. And then you've got others that try to squeak it out as long as possible, and you're getting a price increase every week. Again, it just depends on the vendor. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel for these distributors out there right now. I mean, their margins already were tight. And they're getting pinched, you know, by both ends, both the manufacturer and their dealers. I mean, makes it tough.
Now, I can remember early in this decade, there were price increases every time you turned around. How does this stage compare with that?
Oh, way more. Way more. I mean, the one that stands out in my head, I think it was either 1985 or 86 when we got like seven, you know, we thought seven carpet price increases in the year was a lot. I mean, heck, you blink your eyes are getting that now. I mean, there isn't anybody that's not raising prices every month.
Really?
Maybe every two. But I mean, if you look at it from a dealer's perspective, I get a notice every week that somebody, one of my vendors, is raising their prices somehow, some way, you know, because you got that many that you're dealing with today. It's not like you deal with five vendors.
So you get a price increase. What gyrations do you have to go through to get that in the system and so on? How do you know, what exactly do you have to do?
So in my case, fortunately, I'm very blessed. I happen to have the longest time user of RFMS in the world. His name is Mark Wheat. Mark has used RFMS for as long as RFMS has been around. So he knows the system really well. But I will tell you, here's what makes it easy and hard, right? So I've got some vendors that use the FCB2B program, and we virtually communicate totally electronically. I mean, I get my invoices. We generate POs to them. We get acknowledgments back. We get invoices. We get shipping notices. Everything happens electronically, and it's just basically throwing a few switches in the system and updating that, and then changing and applying our pricing formulas. The problem we have is you still have a lot of antiquated vendors out there that do that. Right. And everything is more antiquated paper wise.
Now, FCB2B, I don't know if we've ever talked about this before, but and it's been around for what, 20 years or something like that?
It's close. Yeah. You've never had Lewis Davis on here for an interview?
Yes. I mean, I've had. Whoever was dealing with it, I've had them on over the years that I've covered this from the very beginning. I guess the question is, how has it progressed? I get the idea that critical mass has not yet been achieved.
No, you've got most of the majors are there, but there's still a lot of dealers that aren't. I, I will tell you, I mean, a lot of associations, groups, buying groups and everything else are seriously looking at right now, if you're not going to be on the FCB2B program, we don't need you as a vendor. You know, why not make things as easy as possible? How about a great one? How about, you know, we still have to buy our still quoted prices on carpet in the square yards, and we sell every day to our customers in square feet. And every time that I get an electronic invoice, my daughter sent me a list yesterday of about 30 some invoices that we were paying online with Shaw, that because of rounding errors, because of the conversion from square yards to square feet, you know, I'm short 5 cents on this ticket. I'm short 41 cents on this ticket. I'm, you know, it's not a lot of money, but what the heck? We're in the world where we sell by the square foot. Why aren't we quoting and buying carpet by the square foot anymore? I mean, heck, they get a bigger raise every time they raise the price. So it's things like that that we're still archaic in our industry when we're supposed to be. I mean, these young people that are coming into our industry cross their eyes sometimes because of the lack of technology that we really are using in the flooring industry.
Something like square yards and square feet, what's the reason that wouldn't change on that? That would seem like it wouldn't be a major undertaking.
They do the rest of their, that's a question for the manufacturers. I mean, trust me, the dealers would just soon have it. You know, next time you get one of the manufacturers on there, ask away, because, you know, it just doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, we've been dealing in square foot for years. Everybody sold a much higher price carpet as soon as we flipped the square foot than we ever did selling it, you know, by the square yard. I mean, our average selling price, I think, by the square yard at the time probably was in the $8 range, $9 range. As soon as we went to square foot pricing, it was $15 to $20, you know, and it's a lot higher than that now.
Interesting. And that you're talking about the retail price increases, what sort of reaction do you get, if any, from consumers when you increase prices on floor cover?
I think what we've had up until now is more of a get in, you know, it's like the car dealerships right now. You can't get them, right? So it's get in line, give us an offer on it. You know, people that needed flooring for the last year and a half, they needed flooring. Or they wanted to fix up their homes and camp out, right? So they knew, because the news was telling them that everything was going up in price. It was a lot easier for us the last year and a half to raise prices. Now, you also have got an issue that, and I haven't noticed this. I was doing a lot of financing, like Synchrony, Wells Fargo financing, prior to COVID. Well, the last 2 years, that's come down quite a bit because I think people had disposable income. I think financing is going to be a lot more important going forward for those that need to have it. But, you know, it's just like everything else right now. I think people are weighing whether they should make the spend now or they should wait a while. I don't remember a time in the 48 years that I've been in the flooring business when anybody's ever raised prices that they've lowered them back. So, you know, I think what's happened now is that you've got consumers that can only spend so much, and now they're just having to accept less quality of a product, or they're going to have to carry paper and finance it to get what they want. But I think they're going to, you know, be buying less of a quality of product.
I've got you.
That's my opinion.
Getting back to FC B2B, and maybe there's some people listening out there that really don't know what that is. Why don't you give us a little capsule of what that is, just so everybody is on the same page?
Well, it was developed to set a standard in our industry, and to, you know, so everybody's kind of familiar with EDI, right? I mean, the way documents are transferred back and forth and what have you. So FCB2B started years ago and was trying to set a standard that everybody would follow so that we could get, you know, some uniformity in our industry and handling all these documents. A lot of people, you know, give you an example. All the major guys can afford to do whatever they want to do, right? I mean, Shaw has their own way of doing things. Mohawk has their own way of doing things. And it's, you know, they're big enough that they can kind of demand people do it that way. But if you're really looking out for your dealer, if you're really looking out for your customer, you should try to make it as easy for the customer to buy from you than it is, you know, to do business. I just think FCB2B was to set that standard and to get everybody on the same page.
Now, the goal, of course, being getting as many people, in fact, getting everybody, if possible, in the industry on the same system. So it goes on really behind the scenes, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it takes all the manual processes out of that. I mean, think about, you know, back in the day when we were pretty much a carpet company, I mean, you remember going into the purchasing person's office and they would have more binders and books and stuff that they had to look up products and pricing on and everything else because we didn't have, you know, a computer system at the time. And this has pretty much taken most of that away. And if we do everything electronically and we can get our product files right, it sure makes it a lot easier for the dealers to operate and do business.
Now, critical mass. Now, I don't know critical mass in terms of percentage of business. That's not yet been achieved. I mean, is more than half of business transacted over FCB2B?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, David. That'd be a good question for Lewis, who runs FCB2B. My guess is no. But I think probably half of my transactions are going FCB2B. I can't speak for everybody else, but keep in mind, if you're a dealer out there and you're not using an industry standard software, I don't believe, and again, I could be speaking out of school, I don't believe FCB2B works with QuickBooks. Now, I could be totally wrong and somebody can email. But there's a lot of dealers out there that operate with QuickBooks. A lot of these one store guys that, you know, really don't have the time, that automation would really help them considerably, you know?
So now, again, I've interviewed hordes of people over the years on this topic, and I walk away with the impression that manufacturers are dragging their feet somewhat, not compelling their customers to get on the system.
Well, it's just the opposite. I mean,
it is.
Yeah, I think it's just, you're probably right there, because I think part of it stems from the dealers not conforming. But I still think there, if we had more manufacturers on the system, we could get more dealers conforming.
Well, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, this was initiated by manufacturers. They're the ones that came up with this FCB2B idea 20 some odd years ago, whatever it was.
Don't believe that. I was with CCA Global at the time, and there was I cannot remember the name of the original one that started out, but I believe they started the whole process on that. And I'm sure I'll think of it after we hang up here, but the manufacturers, I could be wrong.
Anyway, whether it is or it isn't, it would seem to me that they have the control. They could say, okay, we're going to encourage you to use FCB2B by giving you a discount for every order that you enter through this. And it would seem to me that it would save money for everybody. It would save.
Oh, it will save money for everybody.
Getting the 800 number used less. Why hasn't that happened?
Again, I think it goes back to change, right? You know, we've got some manufacturers and dealers, right, that are awesome with automation. They do a great job. But we also have the other side of that scale where we have some very antiquated people. I can't tell you any other reason other than, you know, change is hard for a lot of people, you know. Okay. I think we've got to force it. I think you know, I think technology has got to be used more. We've got to find ways to pick up those pennies of margin that that get lost every day. But I truly believe that more people on FCB2B, from a standpoint of a dealer and manufacturer, everybody wins. Everybody wins. Because what happens is it also makes FCB2B have to be better and have to conform to more of the things. You know, I had a talk with Lewis Davis a few weeks ago at an event up in Nashville. And we talked about how do we add fuel surcharges, how do we add handling fees or whatever these other costs are into these electronic documents so that we can get the product files updated properly with knowing exactly what our true costs are. And it can be done. Again, he can set the standard. He can open up the spots to put the data, but then the manufacturers have to come back and fill those spots with the data that, you know, we need to know.
I would imagine you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, I'm sure that's being done at some point or another.
Yeah, I don't know if it's reinvention. I think it might be modifying the wheel just a little bit, but I don't think it's reinventing it. Wheel's still round. It just needs to, you know, have maybe a couple more spokes in it or something.
I've got you. Let me change the subject. As we mentioned, you are the chairman. I didn't make you the chairman, but you are the chairman of Floor Covering Education Foundation, the FCEF. Talk about the mission of that organization, if you would.
So, you know, there's a misnomer out there that we're a training organization, and we're not a training organization. We work with the training organizations, but our mission really is to, and it's kind of been modified because we were totally flabbergasted with the unawareness of the flooring industry out there as a trade. There was a report put out by the Home Builders Association listing the top 45 trades that were important to them. This was the National Home Builders Association. And nowhere on their list was floor covering installers or ceramic tile. Neither one of those things were even mentioned. Wind turbine operator was on there. Go figure. I guess it might be with all this electric stuff going on or whatever. I'm not sure. But so we've got a challenge, first of all, to add awareness to the high schools and the young people that there is an industry out there that you can make a good living at called floor covering, right? So at that point, it's recruitment into our industry and directing these people to training organizations that can get them started down that path, right? It's also for us to raise funds to help scholarship each of these students and give them a, you know, a kind of a hand in going through this process. So, and then, you know, once they go through this training, either we are there to help direct them to the next training path, right? Because some of them, you know, it's just like going to high school. Well, once you go to high school, you might need to go to college to get the next level and then you get your master's. There's a lot of flooring opportunities out there through the different organizations that can help them progress along. It's also helping them get placed in our industry with dealers that can put these kids to work and start them, you know, integrated into their companies. We've got challenges. I mean, we're still a world of a majority, probably 80% are subcontractors that are installers out there today, and maybe 20% are employees. I think that's going to have to swing, which is another challenge for our kind of antiquated industry. Because HVAC guys, they're employees. More and more plumbers and electricians are employees. They're not subs. We've got to kind of pull that together too. Now, the other thing that we have done is we've worked with the North Georgia Technical System, school system. We are right now in the middle of our second 10-week course that we are doing up there. A gentleman by the name of Dave Garden, who's with CFI, is the gentleman holding that training. I will tell you this, the last graduation class that we had, I got Tim Bolcom and Kennedy Frierson, Tim from Shaw and Kennedy from Dixie, to come over and talk to our graduates the day before they graduated and interview them and to see what we were doing, you know, with these kids. But what has come out of this technical school system is we finally have got an accredited curriculum that now we can take to other states, and other scholarship funds like Hope Scholarships and stuff like that can be used to send kids to these technical schools for training. We've got a list of dealers reaching out to us every day saying, bring it to my area, bring it to my area, bring it to my area. You know, we'll support this in the community college or technical school efforts in our area. Now, we do have challenges there too. You know, a math teacher, science teacher is not going to fill in and start teaching carpet, power stretching and seaming and ceramic tile laying. So, you know, we've got some challenges there. We are looking for and are developing a train the trainer program so that we can get some of these guys that are just starting to get off their knees. They may be in their late 50s, early 60s, but they still have a lot to give our industry. And we're looking for those type of people daily that can convert to a trainer as opposed to an installation person. So, but that's kind of how we operate. And we count on, we create no revenue. This revenue that we need comes from the dealers. It comes from the manufacturers. It comes from the buying groups. I'll give accolades again. The WFCA put up $1 million originally to put the seed money out there. But Shaw Mohawk and Engineered Floors, all three of them very quickly jumped on board and believed in this enough to put their money where their mouth is. We have a board of directors that I firmly believe in, care about our industry. We have representatives from Mohawk Shaw and Engineered Floors, along with some of the training organizations like NWFA, CFI, Tile Council, or TCNA. They're on our board. I've got some people that have recently retired, like Hoy Lanning from J.J. Haynes, who was a pro advocate for us, and Pete Doche, who retired from Shaw. I'm sure he's doing a lot of other things, but he's on our board and believes in this firmly. So we just need the dealers. We need the manufacturers to understand that we've worked in silos for a lot of years. This is the only way we're going to fix this is to tear down those silos and work together. It doesn't mean that me as a dealer might get one of these installers if I put up $100 a month. But what it is going to do, it's going to give us more installers to all fight over instead of hiding in the bushes and following our competitors' installers out on the job and handing out our business cards and saying, come work for me. We need more crews. We need 50 more crews in every decent-sized metropolitan area. We've got to get these kids into this industry. You know, you can't install carpet with an iPad. You know, it takes somebody that's, you know, got some skills, hand skills, mind skills. There's a lot of math involved. They need to understand that. And they got to be, you know, they got to be a visionary to look at a project and see, you know, how they see it finished. So, I didn't inhale, by the way.
Let me go back to the contractor versus employee situation that you had mentioned earlier. It just seems to me that young people today are interested in jobs and not in necessarily getting into a business right at this juncture in their life. That would seem to be a pivotal part of this whole equation.
Well, actually, they're interested in jobs, but like the first question out of their mouth when they come to talk to you about a job is, how much time off do I get? So before they ask me to tell them about the job opportunity, they want to know what their time off is, what their benefits are, and all that.
Yeah, but that is a job, right? I mean,
it is a job. But I will tell you, as a subcontractor, you know, when you're these kids aren't coming out saying, gosh, I want to own my own business. I want to put all this stress in my life. I want to take all this risk. You know, heck, most of them are still living in their folks' homes in their 30s, you know. So you've got to adapt. We have to change. We have to be able to give them a job where they can earn a good wage, where they can get paid vacation time, where they've got access to health care and 401ks and other types of benefits that other industries allow, we've got to be able to do that.
But what does that mean for the industry? Does that mean there needs to be more contractors out there and there's not enough contractors now to make that whole approach successful?
Well, the Blackstone Group did a survey for us a few years back, which is what started this whole process moving. We're losing 5,000 to 6,000 installers a year. They're aging out. I mean, you ask the average dealer out there what the age of their installers are. I mean, mine are in their late 50s, early 60s in some cases. My best installer is 72 years old. I mean, and he's still working for me, thank God. But I mean, that could change tomorrow without a lot of notice. So, I think we got to change. We got to start adapting. We got to start looking at how that works. I think you're going to start seeing too more workrooms. The Home Depots of the world, the Lowe's of the world have been using workrooms for some time now. I think you're going to see more workrooms pop up so that the workrooms would be the employer for the installers and they would act as a subcontractor to the retailers. I think you're going to see more of that happen. But again, that's going to take some investment in our industry. That's going to take some dealers wanting to do that same thing or dealers coming together in a market.
Now, you mentioned working in Georgia with an organization that would train installers and other groups of people. Is this effort in other states as well?
It isn't yet. We literally just got accredited. In fact, our first accredited course that is going to be happening, I believe, is in August or September of this year at the same technical school. We are reaching out to others as we speak. But again, it goes back to what I told you there earlier. We got to have the trainer. Now that we've got the classes and the accreditation done, we got to have the people that can go in and teach the class, right? So we've got to find that as well. This is not an overnight fix. 2 years ago, we started this the December before COVID hit, and nobody in a million years thought COVID was ever coming or going to do anything. And it stalled us out. I mean, we couldn't get out. We couldn't, all we could do was talk to people like we are right now on a Zoom call. And it's tough to develop a business like that, via Zoom. But again, it's a long-term commitment. We're in it for the long haul. It's not going to be fixed overnight. Everybody thought, oh God, we'll just start kicking out installers after putting them through a 5 or 10 week course. That's like a brain surgeon. You want a brain surgeon that went through one year of college? Yeah, let's let them cut off her head. I mean, really, it's like, well, come on. But that's what we've done. I mean, that's what we've done as an industry. We've stopped training. We don't give our people updates like we used to do. Right now we're working installers to death. The last thing they want to do is get done working for the day and go take a training course. They want to go home and sit on the recliner or sit in the hot tub or have a beer. Unfortunately, it's probably too much beer, but this happens.
Funding. Obviously, that's a pivotal part of this whole thing. Talk about the effort at the foundation to fund this whole thing and what are the opportunities out there?
Well, the opportunities are we need funding. I told you originally the manufacturers that stepped up to help us with the seed money initially, but ongoing. I mean, if you're going to fund $2,500 in scholarships for a student, and you need 5,000 of them, the 6,000 of them a year, just do the math on that. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 million just for that per year. Per year. Now, I put out a challenge to the independent retailers of the world of committing $100 a month, which is $1,200 a year, per location that you have, donate it to this system because it's going to go to good use. We're not ramping up a 1,000 employees. We're trying to get as much money, and our goal is that 95% of this will go to the funding of scholarships and schools. But we need everybody to step up. I don't care if you're in Alaska, you're in Florida, you're being affected by this. $100 a month per location, do it as an auto deduct. The long-term thing of this, the long-term plan, is that we somehow figure out to get a penny a square foot into all the products that we buy, and we fund it that way. We had a company at Surfaces, a company called Wellspun out of India, that was the first company to step up and say, hey, listen, we're going to give you a penny a square foot on everything that we do in the U.S. towards your training. And, you know, that really, I believe it's going to amount to about $400,000 to $500,000 in money in an annualized basis to just to begin with. I mean, could you imagine if we could get, you know, Shaw and Mohawk and Engineer Floors and everybody else to get that penny in there? By the way, the dealer pays the penny from the manufacturer and margins it and puts it on to the customer, and the consumer's the one it ends up paying for. That's the way it should work. We're actually planning a summit in, I believe it's in September, to kind of get together and try to figure that part of it all out. We've also applied for some grants that are available out there through the government that we're hoping to at least get a chunk of. We'll see what happens with that. But at the end of the day, we need everybody. Tear down your silo. We need every manufacturer, every distributor, every organization to put their money where their mouth is and help us fix this once and for all.
If somebody who is listening and watching us at this point is interested in getting involved in this and funding and otherwise, what do they do?
One of our websites is fcef.org. Go to fcef.org. There's a lot of opportunities on there that it'll explain to you how you can donate. In fact, I think if you put /donate in there, it'll take you to another site on there. But you can find out all the different things that we've got going. We try to update that on a regular basis as well. You know, we'll be getting out at some of the conventions that are going on. Jim has a pretty busy schedule. I know we'll be at CCA's convention in Nashville. You know, hopefully get to talk to a lot of people there. But $100 a month, guys, help us solve this thing. I mean, $100 a month per location. Please step up.
Very good. Don, I really appreciate you sharing all this with us. Thank you so much.
No, David, you're welcome. You know, it's an industry that has done well for a lot of people. I mean, you know, everybody that listens to this, take a look back at what this industry gave you over the last, whatever, 50 years, that whoever knows how long you've been in it. But this industry has given us a lot. Let's give the next generation the same opportunity and help them with this installation thing. Our industry is strapped right now. We can only sell as much product as we can professionally install, period. You know, we're replacing half of the do-it-yourselfers jobs. So if we can't get it professionally installed, we're strapped. Everybody knows it. Manufacturers, distributors, and dealers. Let's help it out.
I hear you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks again, Don. We've been talking with Don Roberts. He's a retailer. He is the CEO of Central Alabama Flooring. He has 5 stores in Alabama. And this is Talk Floor TV.